She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Abracadabra, and welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Ty and Witch Burnings, or Crushing Witches Under Rocks, whichever floats your boat, really. If you want your witches disposed of, come to us. I'm Charlie Etheridge Nunn. I'm a writer, and for several years I was an unintentional fan of Wizard, The Guide to Comics.
And I'm Miles Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer and a fan of Witchfinder General. Not the death metal punk band, but the 60s film starring Vincent Price in probably one of his more evil and less campy roles. But there's still a little bit of Vincent Price camp because the man can't help himself. Let Vincent Price have his fun.
Damn straight. It's a very good fun movie. I only saw it, I think, last year when I was trying to close off getting the holy trinity of folk horror between that, Wicker Man, and Blood on Satan's Claw, which I've still yet to watch.
But the Blood on Satan's Claw is a really good film, but there is a moment where Zoe from Doctor Who gets sexually assaulted, and it's kind of just off-putting.
Oh no. Oh dear. Wow. Well, there'll be none of those shenanigans here. Instead, there's us, a pair of casual Star Trek fans who like to look at three episodes based around a theme and put them on a big list of best to worst and try not to be dicks about it. We've looked at the magics of Megas too, so now we know literal magic is canon, kind of, in Star Trek. So we're going to look at other times that there was magic or witchcraft in Star Trek. But first, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying recently?
Well, in the last 2 weeks, I went to see a film, and that film was A24's Backrooms.
Ooh.
I went with my wife, who is a far bigger fan of Backrooms and Backrooms-related lore than I am. But honestly, I had a good time. There are points where I was feeling very uncomfortable, because there are two lengthy found footage video camera-esque segments, and while it seems wrong to see a horror film on like the biggest screen in your cinema, it was very uncomfortable at times because I was waiting for something nasty to jump out.
Excellent.
I highly recommend it, and again, it is proof that maybe we could make films for like less than the budgets of most micronations, because I think Backrooms had a budget of 10 mil and is currently making bank.
Mm.
I think that's actually still less than how much Markiplier spent on making Iron Lung.
Wow. Yeah, that mindset, both in film and video games, of we must have all of the money immediately, and we need to show that we're going to get that by spending all of the money as well. Feels like such a destructive thing compared to made this film fairly cheaply, sold it, but it's made good money, but it doesn't need to be, you know, of a slightly larger micronations budget. But yeah,
I just looked, the budget was 10 million. And its current box office is $262.3 million.
Wow.
The backroom set was all like a physically built set, and they made it like look really good. And I'm probably thinking that, you know, that most of the money went on the salaries for the actors, who probably went for scale, including I can never remember his name. Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Oh yeah.
Who in another universe would have been the 11th Doctor, but it never really went through due to, I guess, contract negotiations, and we got Matt Smith instead. But like, he's definitely one of those actors who are like, yeah, I can see him as the Doctor.
Oh yeah, he would have been very good. Yeah, I know very little about the Backrooms kind of lore. I've seen the video, The original one, and I've been to an IKEA and yeah. have a greater grasp of why liminal horror is so is like it is. So yeah, I'm intrigued by the Backrooms.
I honestly think like you're probably going in with less than I did, and I still had a great time. Honestly, I've been writing a blog post about it for my blog, which I still do now, every now and then. And honestly, for me, the Backrooms remind me of working at the hotel, because it reminds you of like all the various function spaces you get in like conference and functioning spaces in hotels, and just how terrifying they look when they're shut down, all the lights are off.
When I was working for a bank, they had the top four floors of a building and only used two rooms at the very top because they were waiting for their contract to run out. And it was incredible. It was so spooky. And everyone's possessions were still there. I still have a coaster. The haunted coaster. Right the here. Coaster. Someone had made a coffee round. And the coaster and cups, they were all there. And yet, no one.
Were the liquids, was the liquid still in the cups?
I mean, it was like dried out coffee at the bottom of them. And yeah, it felt like maybe they'd been told you've got 5 minutes to pack up and then we set the dogs on you or something, because there were some really useful boxes that were half filled with people's personal possessions. There were family photos in that building.
Okay, Charlie, given the British aristocracy in banks, are you sure that there wasn't a sex cult, murder, orgy sacrifice? You may have almost stumbled on some Eyes Wide Shut level bullshit.
Maybe. There weren't, I didn't see bloodstains, but, you know, they could have tidied it all away, put some sheeting down.
Look, do you know, like bloodstains are far easier to remove than coffee stains.
True.
So, Charlie.
Yes.
What non-Star Trek thing have you enjoyed which has not invoked the god Mammon?
I mean, it might. I'm only a few episodes in, but I've been watching a TV show on Apple called Widow's Bay.
Oh, Widow's Bay is great.
It's been so much fun. I was pitched it as, what if Parks and Rec, but spooky? And yeah, you can definitely see that. Yeah, I'm still, as my kind of side recommendation, still enjoying No Gods, No Mayors, a podcast about mayors and why are they like that. And seeing this poor mayor trying to make anything work in a town that is very haunted has been really good fun. And I've just seen the episode with Patricia's party.
Oh, God. Oh, that episode was an anxiety attack waiting to happen.
So much of it is, where you just spend so long waiting for the other shoe to drop and go like, is it going to be something funny? Is it going to be something utterly pants-wetting? And it proves that there is that fine line between comedy and horror perfectly.
I think the episode which has been the creepiest for me so far has been when he stays at the bed and breakfast. And like there's the guy who you have it towards the end where you have the one guy who they make stay in the room for 30 seconds at a time. And they don't say what happened, but it very strongly implies that time worked differently for him. And he's just like, why did you wait so long?
It's been very good at not showing too much and not saying too much about the horrors. Keep it vague.
Yeah.
Keep it mysterious. And yeah, that's how you do it, guys.
And by guys, we mean fucking Ryan Murphy.
Yeah, we do indeed mean Ryan Murphy. I keep forgetting at some point there will be another American Horror Story.
What? Why? Why?
I don't know. They're desperate enough to do whatever it took to get Jessica Lange back. That's about all I know.
Yeah, I think we're about six episodes in, and it's been a good man. Apple TV is winning like the TV streaming wars, because like nearly all the shows of theirs I've watched have been like gold. Like I finished the second season of Shrinking. If you've not watched Shrinking, I highly recommend it. If only for the wonderful sight of an elderly Harrison Ford being given material that he's invested in doing. Mm-hmm. It is so nice after all this time to see Harrison Ford clearly give a shit with his career.
Wow. God, any time that he's not sleeping for a role is kind of incredible.
Yeah. The man can act. And it's like the guy basically gets to play like the Dr. Cox character if Dr. Cox were a psychiatrist. And it's great. It's amazing. Like, yeah.
Excellent. Well, on that note, let's move to something far more mysterious. To the world of magic.
Ooh. Magic.
Lightning bolt. And so on. Right, our first episode of the day is Star Trek Voyager, Season 6, Episode 17, titled Spirit Folk. This aired on the 23rd of February 2000. It was written by Brian Fuller and directed by David Livingston. The UK number one hit was All Saints with Pure Shores, and the US had Savage Garden with I Knew I Loved You, which I saw the YouTube video, and was Savage Garden a boy band?
I don't know. I don't usually watch the videos. I actually just listen to the songs. I had to be honest with All Saints. Charlie, mm-hmm. would you think less of me if I confessed that I was listening to it while I was cleaning my kitchen and I went into full on like 90s Brighton nightclub dance zen? I was like throwing my hands in the air. I was doing weird shapes. Like, I haven't danced this. The best part was, I didn't get exhausted after 10 seconds.
Hey.
Which, you know, for a man of my age and my condition and my weight, is always a good feeling.
Excellent.
But, yeah, well, I was doing some proper, like, you know, you could see me on the feed. Like, I was doing some prime weird shapes.
Wow. Okay, good. Yeah, yeah. Just like, bring it right back to the event and all that.
I did a big fish, small fish cardboard box.
See, Emma thinks I made that up.
Oh no, come, like, I've not done a big fish, small fish cardboard box since the Obama administration.
Wow. Okay, good. Well, yeah, I'm pleased to evoke this in you.
In the States, I find it easier to infer to how, you know, moments of time to people in America by which presidential run I was living through, because I've lived through at least five more presidents than some people I work with.
Oh no.
I'm old.
Yeah. But yeah, Savage, like, All Saints, always like a bit of All Saints. Savage Garden, yeah, less so. But yeah, the sound of it felt very boy band. And then the video, I had to quickly look up, and the lead singer was 27 years old at the time, where his love interest was a 17-year-old Kirsten Dunst in it. So I saw her, I was like, Kirsten Dunst?
Are you sure you weren't watching Interview with the Vampire? Are you sure you weren't watching someone's fan-made Interview with the Vampire music video that they set to this song and then just put on YouTube like 20 years ago?
Alas, no. Okay. No, although I am very much looking forward to the third season of that, which is Vampire Lestat rather than Interview.
Okay. And it looks
very fun.
All right. Charlie, you have 5 minutes to recount the episode Spirit Folk. Just so you know, for as long as you can consistently maintain a stereotypical Irish accent, I will add an extra minute to your time.
I don't think I can.
Okay, so
hopefully I won't. Okay.
Okay.
I know we've got at least one Irish listener, so
look, if we're what start the troubles again, look, you know,
oh, it'd be so awkward.
Okay, look, we're both from Brighton. They had one job in 84 and they botched it.
True. Yeah. I mean, she got hers eventually, but still.
The long way around.
Yeah. Anyway, on that note, 5 minutes, Spirit Folk, yes.
Right. give us your best Bagora and Bagoa.
Bagora, we're on the European Street Paramount backlot, as Tom Paris is up to some wacky hijinks on an old-timey automobile. He gently crashes into some barrels, and an Irish with an O local, Seamus, fleeces him for some money for a pint. Tom's heading to Castle O'Dell soon and gets warned about the Queen of the Fairy Folk. They part ways, and then Seamus spots Tom getting the computer to fix his car, which snaps his teeny tiny mind. Seamus goes to the pub and tells everyone about it. And what about his weird friends? And Seamus reminds him of another town where everyone apparently vanished thanks to spirit folk. But hush up now. Katie's here. And by Katie, we mean Janeway. And Michael, the bartender, is very sweet on her. He gets her some tea, which feels a bit odd for a pub, but sure. They get a flirt on, and while they're a bit too busy for a date, they do have time for a game of rings. Over on Voyager, Harry Kim's in the canteen, dressed smartly and replicating some flowers. Tom knows he's on a date with a hologram girl, because that's the only way he's getting a date, and decides to prank him. Torres tells him that they've been taxing the Fairhaven hologram. A hologram by keeping it constantly on and running, like my old PC when I used to torrent television shows all day. Wait, no, that wasn't me. It was someone else. At night, Harry's on a date with Maggie the hologram, followed by Paris, followed by Seamus and his drunk mate Milo. They freak out when Tom transforms Maggie into a cow, and then he and Harry are called to the bridge, so they need to leave her like that, which is really disrespectful, guys. Seamus and Milo take Maggie the cow to the church, where the doctor is hamming it up with a sermon, giving all the energy of hellfire and brimstone preachers, but trying to get them to respect each other. The doctor says, no, no, you boys have been pranked, but Maggie the cow protests at this. He dismisses everyone but the cow, and then respawns Maggie back in town. Seamus and Milo find her, and she is perplexed. She's had a weird dream about being naked, but for a cowbell, both in town and in church, and whatever floats your boat, Smag. Over at the pub, Milo mentions talking to Harry Kim about the weather, and suddenly it got better. And everyone's got stories. And what about Neelix? He's obviously a leprechaun. And Edith mentions seeing the doctor literally just vanish, and somehow she's only just brought it up now. Michael suggests they all chill out, although, yeah, he's got reasons. And at night, Janeway's seeing Michael and he gifts her a book, The Fairy Queen. She loves it, and he mentions all the odd talk about her and her friends, hence the book. He's been checking into her and no one has records, which feels like a skill issue on whoever made the program. She's concerned and ends the program, hopefully not, while Kim's balls deep in some hologram. Janeway grills Tom, and why did these people notice the inconsistencies? Tom apparently tried to boost the program to keep it running all the time, and Harry blames the cow incident. The pair summon Michael's hologram and he freaks the fuck out, understandably. He shouldn't notice when they talk about him like he's not there, or that he's in a holodeck. He decides to play along and act like everything's completely fine. Then they send him back and reckon they can fix all the holograms. Michael reappears and speaks to the town's doctor, not the doctor, and mentions he was summoned away by spirits. Tom already knows that Michael was faking, and the boys have to go to the holodeck themselves to sort it out. Chakotay reckons maybe Janeway should be honest with Michael. Shut up, Chakotay. The boys open up a panel in the pub and are being watched. Somehow, Seamus is an authority rather than just a drunken lout. He suggests guns and incantations and red twine and ash berries. And the mob pile into the pub. Seamus shoots for holodeck right in the safety protocols. Ooh, painful. Over on Voyager, they realise they can't deactivate the programme. And Torres reckons just switch it all off. But that'll scrap the programme and Neelix doesn't want to lose his stories. They send the doctor to sort this out. And to his credit, he makes a wonderfully dramatic entrance before being immediately captured and having his mobile emitter removed. Because of that, he's part of the program now, and some terrible spoon-based hypnosis actually works. He explains.
Terrible spoon-based hypnosis. Yeah. He's only in it for a little bit, but Robert Picardo's just hamming it up.
When he gets to do that, like both with this and when he got to do the opera in Starfleet Academy, it's like, yeah, you can feel the actor's enjoyment.
So do you think the Doctor is like the world's first hologrammatic drama kid?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I'm not quite sure how he got that way, but yes, he's definitely, like, I mean, he's always a precocious ham.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
All right, you ready to finish off, bring it all home?
Yeah, let's do this.
All right, and begin.
So, the Doctor is immediately captured and gets his mobile emitter removed, integrating him with the program and getting him hypnotized. He explains to everyone what Voyager is, and Michael nabs a mobile emitter, only to appear on the bridge and once again kind of freak out a bit. Janeway decides, okay, let's be honest, and she shows him space, along with corridors. He recognises a few of the extras and asks why they're interested in Fairhaven. They like it. Everyone likes it. It's some kind of weird craze currently. And Janeway asks, you know, even if we're not from there, are we still welcome? Now, back in town, things have sadly escalated. The townsfolk are getting ready to burn Paris, Kim, and the Doctor. Janeway and Michael appear and explain that, no, we want peace. Janeway apologises and says they didn't mean to frighten anyone, and all the magic was benevolent, apart from the cow thing, thanks, Tom. And he won't do that again, honest. Janeway says they can leave and never come back, but, you know, we'd like to remain friends. And, go on then. Over on Voyager, Torres says no more forever LARP, but let's let them keep their memories so everyone can see if they're accepted. And they are. Pub.
1 minute, 26 seconds. I don't think that any other episode of Star Trek has basically had its plot begin because Tom Paris tried to cockblock someone with a cow.
I've not seen all of Voyager, so I cannot definitively say that.
I'm sure there is definitely an episode. I'm sure there has been an episode of Deep Space Nine where Odo tries to cockblock Quark, because that feels like something Odo would do.
Oh, definitely.
He would say he's doing it for the lore, but you know he's just wanted to cockblock Quark.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, he's... Yeah, he'd take a malicious joy in it. But yeah,
or alternatively, Miles O'Brien is trying to cockblock Bashir.
Of course. Well, yeah, just for the fun of it.
So, this was definitely made when Cole Meany was no longer on contract.
Speaking of which, his ex-wife was one of the villagers. Barbara Dowling was Edith, and she was also in Zardos.
Hooray! The best movie ever made.
But yeah, like, the accents were incredible. And I mean that as, yeah, they strain credulity. I'm sure some of them were actually Irish. But, oh my, some of them, like Milo, the drunken friend of drunken Seamus, was Ian Abercrombie, who I mostly remember as Mr. Pitt from Seinfeld. Always has a very hoity-toity voice, and you could hear it fighting to come through with all of his Irish from all he'd speak. It's like, no, man, right? You've got to put the theatre away just for this one episode. So yeah, that was amazing to hear.
Look, Picardo's playing a preacher. He's the only one who could do theater this week. That's how much the budget can extend.
Oh, it was magnificent, his theater, like, shouting. It brought me right back to the Daemons from Doctor Who, and the kind of church set, and have the master all bashing and
the Daemons has one thing this episode thankfully doesn't.
Morris men. Yeah, luckily there were Morris men here. I loved the idea that this was mostly through the perspective of the holograms. I feel in a way if they could have like threaded that needle to go entirely, this is all just through the perspective of holograms, that would have been incredible. I mean, you probably wouldn't need to cut too many scenes out. That idea of going, yeah, of course the holograms would think they're witches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Although we all know what happens to the other village, and let's be honest, it's probably imperialism.
Yes. Yeah. I did write down in my notes, it'd be nice if that was a previous hologram village that had been erased because of some kind of awkward thing. Like, again, Tom and Harry's pranks got way out of hand, and they decided just to erase that village and start another one down the way.
Neelix got caught with a cow and it escalated.
Oh, no. God, yeah, and poor Maggie the cow. That was very unfortunate. Although, you know, got to see Harry having to kiss a cow.
Yeah.
Funny.
Comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm intrigued as to why this program over all others. Why this is the craze in Voyager for, I don't know, weeks?
I get the feeling, I think that Voyager kind of exists as a microcosm. You know how in Judge Dredd, in Mega City 1, the entire city is so just unemployed and poor that they have nothing to do but just get obsessed with these weird crazes for like a couple of weeks, like Boeing, the Miracle Spray, or like Fatty Olympics. So maybe because Voyager is just stuck in deep, 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 deep space, there is literally nothing to do but to get obsessed with whatever hyperfixation Tom Paris has this week.
Uh-huh. Or like when everyone got into Animal Crossing for a short time. And it's like, yeah, you know, oh yeah, this person's storyline with Maggie was this way. I guess, you know, if you want the grim version of it, then HBO's Westworld.
Like, I'm sure there was a week where everyone on Voyager was really into Sudoku.
Hmm. Yeah, holodeck's not even needed for that one. Just Sudoku on the pads. Yeah.
Sadly, Neelix's improv group did not go too well.
I think it's probably for the best.
I mean, you know, the Doctor would. You know, the Doctor would want to. Would actually. The Doctor would be insulted that he was not invited to join the improv group.
Well, yes. And of course, the USS Enterprise D would have had several Shakespeare groups springing up and some improvised ones as well. Yeah, I could see that kind of, like, no one tell him about the jazz music that they did.
The Enterprise D would definitely have several Shakespeare groups, one of whom would be made up of anti-Stratfordians.
Oh, God. terrifying. Yeah.
So this might be the most awkward way to introduce your hologrammatic boy toy to your friends by literally having him beamed onto the bridge.
Yeah. Go like, yeah. So my fake hologram boyfriend is, first of all, exists. And second, is here now. And very worried about everything. Yeah, like, recently with Workforce, we saw a Janeway romance plot, and that's one thing, but with this, of like, oh yeah, like, she's getting into the hologram guy kind of thing, which, I mean...
So what do you think, the kind of social stigmata of, like, regularly fucking a hologram is in the Star Trek universe? Because it seems to be, it's fine unless it's a hologram based on an actual person, in which case this is just kind of creepy.
Yeah.
But like, if it's your AI waifu, that's fine.
And what if it becomes self-aware? You know, like, what if it's hologram Moriarty?
What if it breaks up with you?
Yeah. Oh.
What if the hologram, what if, let's be honest. Hologram, Harry Kim might be the only person who gets legitimately dumped by a hologram.
I was literally going to say, let's ask Harry. Oh, dear.
Oh, God. I feel sorry for Garrett Wang.
Yeah, yeah, always seems like a nice person. And yet, yeah, the more that we see of Harry Kim, the more it's like, yeah, he's earned this ire, really.
I'm sorry, again, as we've accused Wesley of, I'm sure Harry, the moment he holds a girl's hand, will scream to Tom, I've held a girl's hand, I'm not a virgin anymore.
Yes, definitely. And it was partway through this, I was like, oh my god, that's the Irish guy from that episode of Lower Decks.
Oh.
The Georgia one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he appears in that. Which is weird. But I guess, yeah, if they left it on or left it kind of aware, then yeah, why not?
At least, you know, at least Janeway's not dating the creepy clown.
Yeah, that'd be rough. If she heard about Michael being there, would Admiral Janeway have been like, well, it's time to go to the Voyager Museum?
And that's how Janeway got banned from her own museum.
Mm-hmm.
Admiral, can you stop mounting the displays, literally? I think it's time to admit, like, we've kind of lost the plot on this one. Because also, this seems to be, like, the lowest stakes episode of Star Trek we may have seen.
I love how low the stakes were. The safety's on for almost all of it. The big risk is that they lose their soap opera. That's it. That is all that the real stakes are. Because if they were literally going to burn Harry and Tom and the Doctor, they could just go find, wipe it, just fucking format the disc. It's fine.
Let's see if we have Corey.
Exactly. Oh, God, yeah.
Do you quick question. Do you think Coronation Street is still going in the era of Star Trek?
See, I was never a Coronation Street person, but we were an EastEnders family.
You're an EastEnders family, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
But like, I think, isn't Corey like the longest running British soap opera? I
think so. Yes, but yeah, like there'd be ways of doing it, or just, you know, switch it over to a holo program.
Maybe, you know how there in the Sex Scandal episode, there's a planet Scotland. Maybe, yeah. And we know you have planets which are basically, here is this, like, ancient tribal society that we're trying to recreate. Do you think there's a planet made up of various aliens and humans who discovered the ancient transmissions of Coronation Street and have model their entire society?
Oh god, yeah, definitely.
Planet Rover's Return.
Oh my god.
See, this is why the British don't do Star Trek, because this will be what we would do.
What, Planet Queen Vic?
Yeah, Planet Queen Vic. Planet,
oh, I guess Planet Wolford.
Planet Mitchell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you slag. Right. Okay, as we're getting onto this, it's probably time to consider putting this on our big list of best to worst Star Treks. The list is currently at 208 entries long, with number one as Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Number 100 is DS9's The Forsaken, where, Michelle tries to get off with Odo, and they get some sweet heartfelt moments in a lift afterwards. And down at the very, 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 very bottom, we have Star Trek Section 31. So, yeah, this is a very frivolous episode. It's not necessarily the most Star Trek episode, but it's still a lot.
I think it's interesting because it does kind of touch on, like, the holodeck. And once again reminds us that the holodeck is the most dangerous invention ever in Star Trek. And why do they have these things on a ship, given how often that these fuckers break down?
It's madness. Is it the risk element of going, I know it's got safety on, but it could explode at any time. It could become sentient. And, you know, it's just not as thrilling if that's not possible.
Look, is the need for regular holographic sex that important to people in Starfleet?
Look, long missions, man. 5-year mission.
Do they not want to awkwardly cop off with their co-workers that much?
I mean, maybe they've run out. Or maybe it's a thing of just going, well, I don't know. Like, I could get off with a colleague, but it's going to be awkward. So this hologram that we can just, you know, once the program's over, it won't know because it's not sentient. Yeah, it's just like a fleshlight in a way.
All right, I quit. All right. It's like, it's not bad. Like, the episode's not bad. It's just kind of, yeah, this has, we have 24 episodes of TV to make. Here's number 17.
Yeah, yeah. And personally, I'm fine with that. I like that. Yeah, give us these silly episodes.
I mean, I'm surprised that given that this is a Brian Fuller joint, I'm surprised that you didn't tell me that there was a cannibalism subplot.
I looked. I didn't see any kind of like, yeah, you get to find out that they completely like break their sanity and they all go insane and start ripping each other apart.
I was surprised you weren't going to tell me that like the cow malfunctions and turns into like a cow human hologrammatic hybrid.
Yeah, and it can only scream.
Had they broken Brian Fuller down that much?
Maybe. Yeah, I didn't realize he stuck around this long.
God, like, this is difficult.
It is. It is. Okay. So as far as a frivolous kind of fun thing that's mostly set elsewhere, we've got Captain's Holiday with Picard going to the fuck planet.
Oh, yeah.
113. At the moment, getting into some archaeological adventures, you know, placating Patrick Stewart's need to be the action hero.
Okay, I've got at low, just below that at 115.
Oh, yeah.
Lower decks is I Excretus, where everyone does hologrammatic, where everyone gets holo drills.
I think this is probably better for that.
And Boimler tries to platinum the Borg.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think, as entertaining as that is, this feels like more of one coherent story, even if the accents are really...
Okay, so above that, at 114, we have season one of TNG with episode 13, Data Law, where we get Law, Data's evil brother, and Data's contractions, which, you know, lack thereof, which he has never used before this point in the series. Honest. Don't at us.
Yeah, yeah, of course. God, I mean, that one is probably more relevant than this, but I'd probably end up watching this.
Yeah.
Like, as fun as a crystalline entity is, you know, that scamp, I don't know, I think, yeah.
All right, I'll agree with you, and we'll put this at the new 114.
Nice. Okay. Oh, God.
Oh, great, you broke it.
I broke it. No, no, it's all right. It's alive. Alakazam! Our second episode is Star Trek Discovery Season 2, Episode 2, titled New Eden. This aired on the 24th of January, 2019. With a teleplay by Vaughn Wilmot and Sean Cochran, story by Agatha Goldsman and Sean Cochran, and directed by Big Johnny Boy Frakes. The UK and US number one hit was Halsey with Without Me, which, like, I enjoy an amount of Halsey. As an amount of fun, overwrought kind of stuff, I don't care as much for Without Me.
It was fine.
It's fine. But what I do care for is to hear how those funny disco people are doing this time, as it feels like it's been a while.
It has actually been a while.
It has. So, you've got 5 minutes. Otherwise, the Red Angel will take you away. So, begin.
So, there's some Red Angel nonsense and there's some strange signals out in the galaxy. Pike, who is now captaining the Discovery, gave Spock some leave so he could go investigate the signals. Although, it turns out, as we open this episode, that's bullshit. Because Spock is actually in a psychiatric unit. Michael Burnham wonders why Spock didn't tell his family before realizing, oh wait, this is Spock. He's that one family member who won't tell anybody anything in the group chat. Anyway, so they're investigating these signals. Stamets is really pissy that he keeps saying Hugh, his dead boyfriend, who got killed in the previous series, in the Mycerial Network. Stick a pin in that. We've done that episode where all that gets sorted out. Meanwhile, Tilly has been retrofitting the Discovery's sensor systems to find the location of the five signals, which is fine. But the show needs Michael Burnham to do it. So Michael Burnham goes, yep, good idea, but you are wrong in every respect. What if we did this? And they do that. And they discover one of the signals is far out in the Beta Quadrant. They spore drive over there. Stamets doesn't see Hugh, and he's very pissy about it. And they find a planet. A planet with humans on it. And it turns out that those humans have been there for 200 years. Wah, wah, wah?
Ooh.
But 200 years ago was World War III. No one was out that far in space. They see that the planet and the people on it have a kind of pastoral, almost folk horror existence. So Pike, Michael Burnham, and I always get her name wrong because she doesn't do much in the show, is Kayla Detmer.
No.
Wait, no. That's not Detmer.
It's that Woshkin.
Yes. Woshkin, who was from a Neo-Luddite colony. Okay. Ignoring the fact that that's not what Luddite means, so they sneak on down, and to do so, it involves teleporting right in the middle of the church. Not a good idea if you're doing we don't want to disrupt this planet's natural development. They claim to be from the north, and they find an agrarian society, one of whom is the church, is led by a man called Jacob. Meanwhile, Tilly is experimenting with this big, heavily magnetic bit of rock to try and find a way of fixing the spore drive so Stamets doesn't have to keep using it. Something goes wrong and she gets knocked out horribly. When she wakes up, there's a nervous woman there who doesn't seem to be like being around other people. Saru gives Tilly a telling off for being reckless, but it's not going to jeopardize her place in the command training program that she's on. But Tilly, hey, self-care. Meanwhile, Michael Burnham, Oeshka, and Pike try and get a handle on what happened. It turns out that 200 years ago, some soldiers and some families were held up in this church as the bombs were dropping in World War III. And then the Red Angel appeared and brought them to this far distant planet. And they adjust. Some people believe that Earth has been destroyed, and others, especially Jacob, thinks that Earth still exists. Pike doesn't want to violate General Order 1, the Prime Directive, and so we're not gonna get involved with these people. We're just going to try and get the information we need and then leave. Meanwhile, on the Discovery, we're gonna get involved because it turns out there is a field of radioactive debris which will hit the planet in like 57 hours and cause a nuclear winter. So the crew of Discovery, they plan to do a Starfleet and save the day from on high. Tilly, who is problem solving, she's had espresso, a screen cap I have used in many a chat in the workplace, realizes that they can use the gravitational pull of the big rock to get all the radioactive donut, to get all the radioactive...
Time is up! The debris is hit!
No!
Oh no. I mean, that's right. It's just a bit of debris. You know, I've been living in a building site. It's mostly debris. You'll get used to it. Anyway.
Debris in X-Men comics.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I think that's most of what you can see in this Lovely view on Zencaster. But, yeah, continue.
So Tilly wants to use the tractor beam and the big rock to kind of create a magnetic pull to pull all the stones away from the planet's gravitational pull. Best of all, the Discovery is going to have to do a space donut.
Yeah.
And everyone's down to do a fucking space donut. Stamets plugs himself into the spore drive to get them to where they need to be just in time. Meanwhile, back on the planet, Pike, Michael Burnham, and Oeshka discovered that Jacob has been hoarding a lot of the pre-war, a lot of the World War III technology in the basement of the church. And Jacob, Jacob turns up, knocks him out, and steals their shit, locking them in the basement. With the help of a magnet and a trusty bit of wire, that great old staple used in countless Enid Blyton famous five novels, Michael Burnham, Pike, and the others escape. And asked Jacob, was like, hey, they're aliens, they're from Earth, they have technology. Oh no, they've set the phaser to explode. Pike runs, grabs the phaser, and jumps on it as the phaser explodes, causing a lot of injuries. Michael Burnham, wanting to stick to General Order 1, asks the people of New Eden to bring Pike to the church so they can beam out in safety. The day is saved, the radioactive debris is swept away, and Tilly is congratulated by the young ensign from earlier, who calls her a nickname from someone she went to a school whose name I can't remember. And it turns out when Tilly does some research, her friend died 5 years ago.
Oh my god!
Back on the Enterprise, Pike is fine. And Michael Burnham is just like, yeah, kind of twisted the whole General Order 1 thing. You know, it's not great to disobey orders, especially since last time I did so poor, it went so poorly, we went to war with the Klingons. Pike's like, yeah, but sometimes we should actually, you know, breaking orders is fine. So he beams back down to Jacob and goes, hey, you are right. We're actually from Earth. Earth is cool now. We're part of a federation. We want the source of your signal, which is an old camera from a soldier's helmet, and in return, we will trade you this nice, tasty power cell. Don't lick it. Jacob doesn't lick it. Instead, he plugs it in, and the New Eden church lights up as bright as anything on the planet of New Eden. They plug the camera into the computer, and we see the visual footage of the soldiers and the civilians in the church being picked up by the Red Angel, the same figure who saved Michael Burnham in the previous episode. And Michael Burnham says, yeah, so I didn't tell you about the Red Angel, but that saved me. Something's up. The end.
Ooh, 3 minutes and 10 whole seconds. Admittedly, there were a couple of incidents that may have interrupted that, but... yeah. What do you reckon happened to New Eden after all of this?
I think they basically went the way of the M. Night Shyamalan film, The Village, and they went staunchly anti-technology, set up a cult, and had random people in the city, in the village, dress up as wolf-like monsters to keep everyone in line.
Of course, all vague allegories for... Pike and Michael and Dwoshkin.
Either that or sex cult.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, the other thing I was wondering was, like, how quickly are they going to burn Jacob as a witch? Oh my god, he lit up the whole church!
Like, I am surprised that the people of New Eden were just very kind of like, yeah, okay, fine, this is cool, this is fine.
Yeah.
At no point did they kind of go, and we shall kill the interlopers, which is usually what you kind of expect from an episode of sci-fi like this.
Yeah, like we're somehow a kind of amalgamation of several different beliefs.
I've not
learned the extremism side of any of them.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I like the stained glass window, which was like an amalgamation of all the various different faiths. But you notice that Judeo-Christianity is the primary one.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a very Discovery thing to go, oh yeah, in the future, or this culture's replaced all of these individual fractious religions with one kind of combined uber religion, that sort of thing. It's interesting getting back to it. And I'm pretty sure when this episode hit, I was like, oh, thank God, they're starting to do more episode plots. And even though there's, you know, the through line of Red Angel, it felt like, oh, they're doing a thing of the week. You know, they're actually facing some Star Trek problems, even if Michael took a lot of convincing to actually lie. Because initially when she's talking to them and they're like, oh, yeah, we've got all of our kind of weird combo religion. And Pike's like, yeah, yeah, of course. So do we. We're from the north, but definitely this planet. And Michael was like, well, or
science.
Or your gods are bullshit and science exists. It's like, no, 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 please don't internet atheist this. We're undercover, Michael.
Michael, have you not seen the Wicker Man?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. We do not want to end up Wicker Manned. For all we know, that's part of the combo religion as well.
You know what have really improved this episode?
Mm?
Musical numbers.
Yeah.
Like the Wicker. I love showing people the Wicker Man, the original Wicker Man with Christopher Lee and Edward Woodward, because at no point do I tell them the songs are going to happen.
Yeah.
And also, they're great songs. Although, I always want to sing Landlord's Daughter when I'm at work, and that's just awkward.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I assume there may be some HR issues.
No, my HR manager and I have an understanding. If she laughs at my jokes, she can't punish me for it.
Wow. Okay. This
is less an understanding and more of a threat on my part. It's like, right, you laugh at it, I can't get punished for it.
Right. Not a desperate, ludicrous defense. Again, it was interesting going back this far, seeing those uniforms, seeing Pike in that uniform.
I didn't realize how much hair. He had normal people hair.
Yeah.
Like, the Pike of Strange New Worlds has like fucking anime hair, like 80s anime hair by comparison.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah. I could see him dressing in one of those uniforms from like Mobile Suit Gundam.
Oh, yeah.
The way he rocks that suit. Even so, you still get that slight sense of wonder and of fun of like, yeah, I'm with Starfleet. There are rules, but... You know, more like guidelines, surely.
Michael Byrne was like, we're Starfleet, we don't lie.
Oh God, I definitely had that thought listening to her speaking there. Like, oh no. And yeah, I would want to know why the Neo-Luddites were Neo-Luddites. And also, it didn't feel like Awoshkan did much with that.
She fixed the lock and that was it.
Yeah, yeah. I know they had a lot to do. And the episode did feel quite long. I was watching it on a train and in a slight panic of like, oh no, is it going to keep going when I need to change?
Watching this and just seeing all the various different characters, and it's just like, man, all these characters, I wish I knew something more about them.
Yeah, yeah. Detma was talking about doing a donut, like convinced to like, you could do a donut in space, and she's like, yes, yeah, I'm on that. I don't know if there's been like comics or anything that have actually expanded on the cast, but yeah, they all it felt like they all deserved more of an ensemble. And as much as I like later Michael, where she's allowed more of a personality and to be wrong and to not be the center of attention, there's too much of that in these first two seasons. Also, there was a lovely bit with Tilly kind of getting her idea and running off. And then you pause a second and she runs the other way. It's like, that's Tilly.
Yeah, I love it. You always love a good everyone comes together with the idea and like, you know. Again, everyone is on board. Everyone on the Discovery is a giant nerd. And so the idea of doing a fucking space donut just appeals.
Yes. I think sometimes I rag on it for being far too painstakingly earnest. And all these, we are type A spreadsheet nerds. But seeing them go, yeah, we want to do some sick shit. It's like, yes, thank you. Thank you. Even the spreadsheet nerds, my people, the spreadsheet nerds, want to do some sick shit.
And I am the problem solving, I've had an espresso type nerd.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's room for all of that.
Do you think on the Enterprise D, when Riker's in charge and Picard's like on a nap, he just kind of goes over to like Worf or Wesley and just goes, do you want to fucking do a donut?
And from this point on, obviously, that's a thing that is known, because this is before they vanish into the future. So it is known that the Discovery once did a donut.
What other
sick tricks could the others do?
Don't forget, everything about the Discovery is basically classified knowledge. Including the donut.
God, so no one would know.
No.
Like, someone else is out there. Like some other ship, like the USS Claremont, and they did a donut, and they think that they're the first ones to have done the donut.
Is the USS Claremont named after Christopher Claremont?
Obviously.
Oh god, that one probably has like all the kind of brainwashing fetishes going on there.
Well, and a lot of fucking just so, more than the standard Starfleet ship amount.
It's a ship purely dedicated to people who want to get transformed into weird shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, on the whole, I enjoyed the episode. I loved how it's kind of trying to do the Prime Directive thing, but thankfully the people involved on the planet aren't fucking psychopaths. Yes, Jacob's a bit of a dick.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, do you think if he was a bit less of a dick about it, people might have been able to gently be coaxed towards science?
Possibly.
Me and my family, my ancestors, we were all about this. We're basically the guardians of science. So, mate, you're one of those people where I'm like, I want good things for you, but I understand why you're being bullied. And in this instance, I'm going to have to side with the bullies. Which, as a victim of bullying, I have been in those moments as well of like, oh no, I want to help you, but frankly, you deserve this.
Yeah, it's always awkward when you're just like, yeah, I kind of side with the bullies on this one.
Fuck, who knew that would happen? But you did it. Well done. Yeah, Also, I was slightly tickled by this being filmed in somewhere called Balls Falls. Because I am five.
look, the amount of places in England which are basically called like Wet Dick and Knob End.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's time to share the love with Canada there.
Yeah. I'm sure there's someone got some like Americans. I'm from Balls Falls, Minnesota. There would be a lot more earnestness of the Balls Falls.
Wow. Yeah. So, last thing with this. You mentioned the Spock family group chat. Who is the worst person on there?
Fuck. Wait, okay, quick question.
Okay.
Is Cybok on the group chat?
Of course Cybok's in the group chat. All of them.
Okay, all right. I think they're all, I think with the exception of Amanda, they're all going to be annoying.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know Cybok is like posting straight edge memes.
God.
And he's the one, like, you know that Cybok is into MLM and so is trying to get his family to like push his new dietary supplement. Spock just shows pictures of whatever stupid shit McCoy has been up to.
Yeah, sharing memes that the others have shared that are popular on the Enterprise, but not really understanding them himself.
It's basically cheeseburger memes, but with Horta.
Oh,
so it's a Horta with a caption, Aiken has cheeseburger.
And then, yeah, Michael probably just going, that was terrible.
Sarek has his own group chat, which is basically himself bitching about everyone else in the group chat.
Just occasionally, accidentally posting in the wrong one. Wish I'd have eaten Cybok.
Sarek just, all Sarek ever posts is, I have no son. You have Spock like got promoted to first officer on the Enterprise. Thumbs up emoji. Live LLAP Vulcan salute. Sarek, I have no son.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, just be like, well, Sarek owns his own business.
Spock posting, I got to fly through a giant amoeba. That was fun. Sarek responds, I have no son.
Oh, poor Spock.
Sarek has a group chat with Mirror Universe Spock, who he has a perfectly cordial relationship with.
Oh, his real son.
Okay, so Spock family group chat aside,
yes. Which
I think that has to be the episode title.
Oh, God. Right, so, yeah, like, this
one. Okay, what is the high, what is like, I want to see how high we have Discovery.
I think it's 40.
Yeah, with the hope 40. That is you part one, and then immediately after it's 41 with Forget Me Not.
Oh,
I think this was kind of better than both of those, because it's like, hey, it's Discovery doing a Star Trek, and they literally do a Starfleet in this episode.
Oh God, speaking of Cybox, Star Trek 5 is at 39. Let's see. Oh, okay. I don't think it's better than The Devil in the Dark.
No.
Which is at 36. I was talking to my dad about The Devil in the Dark just yesterday, and about the sheer joy of the guy that is evidently on all fours with some kind of goopy curtain on him having to be a lava monster. And like, why isn't there science fiction like that anymore? That was real science fiction.
Was that you or your dad?
That was me.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he was extolling Land of the Giants and how I should rewatch that at some point.
I mean, everyone should rewatch Land of the Giants.
Yeah, fair.
I mean, that's proper sci-fi.
So yeah, I was playing to the audience. Really. Oh
yeah. Yeah, you're extolling the virtues of the Planet of the Apes TV show.
God. So, underneath Devil in the Dark at 37, we've got The Ties of Blood and Water, a far more serious and somber affair. Which, yeah, it is far more serious and somber. I mean, I'd probably watch this.
Yeah.
First out of the two of them, but I mean, a lot of that is my own baggage, really.
Yes, honestly, same. I mean, I'll be honest. I would probably watch, like, Plato's Stepchildren before I watch Ties of Blood and Water again.
Yeah, it's good, but yeah, rough.
Yeah. So, yeah, I am down with this kind of being not as good as The Devil in the Dark, but better than Ties of Blood and Water.
Okay, cool. So that is our highest Discovery episode at number 37. Now, will one ever break the top 25? Who knows?
I'm guessing not.
But
I mean, I don't know. I think
there's some adventure-style shenanigans and hijinks in the final season.
I mean, if like the Time Loop episode didn't make it, what else would?
Yeah. True. God, well, you know, it's a difficult race.
If acclaimed Star Trek Discovery spin-off Star Trek Section 31 couldn't even crack the top 200 of our 208 strong list, what choice does the rest of Discovery? I mean, I think the real question is what is going to end up with the lowest, highest ranking on the list? Star Trek Discovery or Star Trek Picard?
I think Picard. My bet is Picard.
Okay.
Like, I think you and I are slightly immune to the cynical nature of going, yeah, we've got all of your old favourites here with JL. So yeah. And season 3 was certainly more enjoyable than the previous two. Doesn't necessarily make it good, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, to something which is good.
I mean, you can't just, you know, like, bring back Pilly Piper and hope that, you know, he's going to save the show.
Well, our third of... Let's see. I don't know. What would be another magical exclamation? I'm trying to think now.
Spellcasting. C-A-S-U-A-L-T-R-E-K. Casual Trek.
Very nice. Very, very nightmare. Okay, well, after our desperate flailing there, our third and final episode of the day is Star Trek Strange New Worlds, Season 1, Episode 8, titled The Elysian Kingdom. Now, like a few of the later Star Treks, we kind of hit a point of realizing we're on a limited budget of them. So we haven't done much Strange New Worlds lately. And frankly, I kind of dropped off partway through Season 3. I'll get back to it.
I dropped off partway through Season 2.
Yeah, fair.
All my watching...
Have you not met Scotty yet?
What was that?
Have you not met Scotty yet?
No, I met Scotty because we'd done the Season 2 finale and the Season 3 opener.
Okay.
Yeah, but all my watching the casual of seasons 2 and 3 of Strange New Worlds has been out of contractual obligation.
Ah.
Because executive dysfunction has executive dysfunction.
Yeah. I mean, I've literally still seen one more episode of the original series than we have seen. So, yeah, fair's fair, really. Okay. Anyway, The Elysian Kingdom aired on the 23rd of June 2022, all that time ago. It was written by Aleca Cooper and Anitra Johnson and directed by Amanda Rowe. The UK and US number one hit was Harry Styles with As It Was, which we have covered before a few times, to the point where I didn't even listen to it this time. I was like, oh, yeah, I know that one. It's all right. It's fine. Yes, so I'd best get recapping. And I am preparing to overrun because, man, this was an episode.
Okay, so before we start, what would be your if we were turned into fantasy characters based on a favorite or a beloved book, who do you think you would have been turned into?
I don't know. Like,
I mean, knowing your luck, probably Eustace Scrubb from the Narnia books.
Wow, that's harsh. I was going to say unnamed surly merry man, but
you are not a merry man.
Oh, but yeah, that or yeah, some kind of crime of worm tongue style, kind of like yes, king, do look over the balcony.
I don't know. I think I would have been turned into like the innkeeper.
Ooh, that'd be a good role.
See, I keep saying that, like, if I was in Westeros, I would not want to be like a knight or like a horseman or a soldier. I would run a tavern, and I would have every single flag for every single king in a box. And then whenever a king dies or gets his head cut off, flag comes down, new flag goes up.
Nice. I think, given my name, I would probably be a commoner pretending to be a noble or a knight or something.
Same.
Because, yeah, I know my background. We are commoners. We would be living in the filth.
It's like when people tell me, oh, wouldn't it have been lovely to have lived in the time of Downton Abbey? I'm like, my mother's side of the family is Welsh. I would either be dying in a coal mine or in Normandy. Take your pick.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my dad's side of the family were crooks somewhere in Eastern Europe, and my grandmother on my mum's side was found in a swamp. So, yeah, who knows? Who knows what I'd been?
Charlie, I'm sorry, but there has to be a point where I do eventually call bullshit on your family history. And that might be it.
Her surname was Marsh because she was found in one. And I guess the nuns that found her went on Game of Thrones logic far before Game of Thrones even came out.
Well, you know, the history of most surnames in the UK was basically like, you know, this guy is called Millman, so he is Man of the Mill. Although I still believe the first Millman who said, okay, my family name is now Millman, Man of the Mill, is only because he was basically known as Jeff Fucked a Goat.
Yeah, yeah, you'd have to be hiding something pretty rough to get that name. Anyway!
Yeah, anyway, Charlie, son of Marsh, son of Marsh, son of Marsh. You have 5 minutes to get to the bottom of the Elysian Kingdom, or else you will be made to look after a small yapping-type dog.
Oh, no.
And and as we all know, the small yapping-type dogs, they are not good doggos. They are bad.
The yapping-type dogs are the worst types of dogs.
They are the evil units.
Mm-hmm.
Begin!
So, once upon a time, Dr. Mbenga had a daughter who was trapped in a transporter buffer until he could cure her terminal illness. And it was all looking pretty bad, and only Una knew. The Enterprise is doing a routine survey of a nebula. So routine that Pike makes note of it, and Spock says, oh, you're tempting fate by doing that. Mbenga's telling a fairy tale to his daughter, Rakia. She doesn't like the ending, where King Ridley has to make a really difficult choice and a sacrifice. And he says, well, if you survive till you get older, you can become a writer and change the story yourself. The ship tries to move, but it can't. And when they try to go to Impulse, something bad happens. Mbenga ends up going to the bridge to help a dinged up Ortegas, only to find that it's fully in LARP mode. And he is dressed as King Ridley. The bridge of the Enterprise is now a palace room, with Ortegas as the bodyguard, Sir Adia, and Pike's his obviously treacherous lickspittle, Ralph. Anson Mount is having a fucking whale of a time with this role. Mbenga speaks to the computer and gets it to scan a ship, and despite it all being decked out like this, it's apparently fine. Ortegas mentions an ominous fog over the kingdom. Yep, that's the nebula, and apparently an evil Queen Nev did it. She wants King Ridley's Mercury Stone. Mbenga's next stop is to Medbay, where Chapel's some kind of witch healer thingy, and she thinks his tricorder is a healing stone, and she's got some high dopamine levels when she's scanned. Ortegas shows up with Lan as Princess Talia, and respectfully, hello. She's brought her dog too, which is a terrible, terrible yappy type dog. She wants Ridley to fight Nev, and with his tricorder, he might have some additional weapons. Isn't this exciting? The Crimson Guard show up next with Mitchell in charge of them. They're dragging Hemmer off, and they're claiming he's a wizard called Castor. Although, like Mbenga, he's not affected like the others. Really fucking confused by all of this. Ortega says Mbenga needs to unleash the stone, and he admits, doesn't
happen. I'm sorry.
You're right.
Yeah, it's just that sounds like something I would say to if a friend had kidney stones.
Unleash the stone! Oh, no. God, oh, that's horrible.
I'm emotionally 14.
On that terrifying note, yeah, Mbenga decides the best way to get Hemmer rescued is to say Castor knows where it is. And have a planning sesh. Ortegas, of course, suggests violence. And Pike suggests diplomacy. And fine, we'll try that one. Hopefully no one will die. They leave Lan and her little dog too behind. Going through overgrown hallways, they find Pollux, who is also Spock with weirdly ratty long hair, and also, hello. He says rescuing his brother Castor is stupid person behaviour, but it'll help them nonetheless. Is this a trap? Why, yes. Yes, it is. He is working for evil Queen Nev, who gets them all captured. She is a deliciously evil Uhura, who sends them to the dungeon or transporter room with bars on it. Hemmer's there, and Mbenga's happy to have some sane company just for a moment. Apparently, Hemmer felt a telepathic consciousness and pushed it out of his head. They need to go to engineering and figure out what's up and make contact with it. Hemmer uses the magic of science to cut through the bars. Abracadabra! Uhura is immediately aware, and she is not happy about this at all. Over in the halls, Mbenga and Spock's teams clash. Ortegas fights all of the Crimson Guard, and Pike, of course, flees. When things look bad, it's Una. She's Zamara the Huntress, and she and Ortegas' character obviously have a bit of a thing going on. Down in engineering, Hemmer mentions there's a theory about spontaneous consciousness happening, and maybe the nebula's one of those. It's all-powerful and somehow latched onto Mbenga's storytelling. Maybe they should hurt him to see what happens. And no. When he sees Ortegas and Una's bickering, he has a realization. This isn't what happened in the story. His daughter kind of shipped them, though, and wanted to make her own ending. It's using her version of his stories to make this weird fantasy world. Okay, great. So where's Rakia then?
Okay.
Oh no.
Well, okay. You will have to look after the small yappy type dog, which is Christina Chong's actual dog.
Yes. Yeah. Runa Ewok. So feels like crossing the streams slightly with that surname.
I unfortunately got catted while you started your recap, as you saw.
I did see the ship's cat intrude there.
He wants food. That's what his problem is.
Oh, well.
Right. Okay.
We'll try and press on quickly then.
Charlie, are you sitting comfortably?
Yeah.
Brace yourself. Charlie, you must unleash the stone. Go!
Oh my god! Oh, the pain! Anyway, yeah, so, where is Rakia? She's not in the buffer, but she's somewhere on the ship. Spock is listening in and leaves once he's got this news. And Nov gets really excited the stone's a girl. Then that's something you can find and, you know, just steal or kill or whatever. She offers Pike a choice of death or betrayal. And he was already up for betrayal. You didn't have to say anything else. Mbenga and Hemmer realize they shouldn't go and look for where the nebula took Rakia, but where she herself would want to go. His quarters, where she's never been. They're stopped by Nave and Pollux, so Hemmer brilliantly magics up an incredible incantation, taking far too much time, hamming it up, and then transporting them to a cargo bay. Abracadabra, once again, Hemmer loving this. Rakia is in Mbenga's quarters, and yeah, she's cured. Yay! Hanging plotline over. She greets him, and she's happy with how he's been playing the story, as she's aware of what's been going on. The Nebula is her friend, who she will decide to call Deborah the Nebula. And it's all been very nice. The Nebula has been very lonely, and they're good friends now. And Deborah the Nebula speaks through Hemmer and explains all of this. And also, like, Rakia's cured, but if the Nebula lets the ship go, she's gonna die. Oh dear. What a tragedy. Now, King Ridley, aka Mbenga, has to make a difficult choice. Leave his daughter or have the crew trapped in this fantasy world forever. She realizes she kind of needs to make this choice, despite what was said right at the top of the episode. And yeah, she decides to stay. The Nebula rushes over her and she's gone. And then a moment later, she's back. But as an adult, having lived decades of subjective time, she's really happy and wants Mbenga to live his life and not spend ages mourning that she's a Nebula now. So yeah, that's nice. Everything goes back to normal. Everyone's missing 5 hours of time. And Mbenga knows what happened and starts telling Una with, of course, a once upon a time.
Right, that was 2 minutes and 44 seconds.
Okay.
And before I forget, I have to stop the spell. Spellcasting. Oh. KERTLAU... SAC.
Very good.
You had to reverse the spell when you do a nightmare spell casting.
Excellent. Then I won't be eaten by some weirdly animated wall face.
Ooh, nasty.
Nasty. Yeah, so did you notice who wrote the Elysian Kingdom?
I did, because I saw it on the show notes, and that was Benny Russell.
Yeah, so was he slumming it writing a children's book? After all the sci-fi that he'd done.
I mean, don't forget, like, you have writers like Ursula K. Le Guin, who wrote some of the greatest, you know, science fiction that the genre has had, but then also wrote the Earthsea books. I mean, Terry Pratchett did Discworld, but he also did like all his kid books, which were definitely not slumming it.
Yeah. I remember when my brother and I, for one Christmas, got given a Discworld book, and he got given, it wasn't quite Borrowers, but it felt a bit
Truckers.
That was it. Yes. Yeah, and then I read some Discworld, and then I figured I'd got all of Discworld that I was likely to get, and also met some Discworld fans.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. I liked the weirdness of the set with this. It felt almost a bit original series of, we've kind of half covered everything in like some nice tapestries, some plants, that sort of thing. Like, this is kind of a dungeon, but also it is just the transporter room, or engineering looked normal, and then I saw their little brazier kind of things, yeah, and stuff like that. It's like, oh, okay, good. Yeah, almost in the spirit of that half-built Wild West set.
Yeah.
Which was quite neat. And yeah, like, so many of them felt they were having a whale of a time. Like, Anson Mount, definitely far and away, going from captain to complete weasel. Horaka's Hemmer, and yeah, Celia Rose Gooding as Queen Nev.
She went full panto villain.
Oh my. That was magnificent. Like, proper cartoon villain.
Proper, like, you know, just big.
Yeah. Big, but in an entertaining way, where you could imagine her tormenting children in some kind of, like, kind of after-school kids show.
I forgot how much fun Hemmer is in this show. Yes. And I miss his character deeply, because, okay, I love a grumpy guy with a heart of gold. I also love when the grumpy guy goes, this is silly, but I'm joining in.
Yeah. I liked that, where, yeah, his confusion at it all didn't stop him having any kind of buy-in to it. As, yeah, fuck it, why not at this point? I completely forgot, because this is from back when I saw it when it was airing, and now I've seen it again for the second time. I forgot that Spock was a Weasley baddie in it. And yeah, God, I did feel it was a little much that Spock and Hemmer were Castor and Pollux. It's like, guys, come on. You got some better names in you, surely. But no, apparently not. I mean, Hunger Games didn't, but...
I mean, you know... I know of writers who use subtext and they're all cowards.
True, fine. You win this time.
It does kind of seem weird that they did set up M'Benga has a sick kid subplot.
Yeah.
And then seem to kind of write out the subplot, not even before the time the first season is done.
And frankly, I got it, but also it felt like it was then going to be literally his only subplot.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, but instead it's like, hey, how about war angst?
I guess some war angst. Yeah. Yeah, that is odd.
Like
in retrospect, think about it in compared to framing him how he is here.
It is just kind of like, it is a thing of, you know, it is, I know we talked about it in the Ferengi episode of turnover of production.
Yeah.
And I feel like with Strange New Worlds, there's a lot longer lapse between when we make this stuff and then when we air this stuff. But it's just like, and it's, given how one of the complaints I know that Avery Brooks had about the Cisco was that the show ends with him becoming an absentee dad by basically swatting off to be a god, to be a godlike entity, and leaving his wife and kid behind. Mm. And the unfortunate implications of that, that you have Mbenga, who is also an African, who is also a character of non-white descent, of non-white heritage. And like his plot line is, I'm just going to leave my kid in a nebula.
Yeah.
It's better for her this way.
Do you think he ever comes back to the nebula?
I don't know.
Like, it'd be interesting going, okay, does he visit?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the nebula now hopefully knows not to grip onto ships or anything.
Yeah, and not to make people, you know, like, live out their new best friend's fix-fic.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, do their weird LARP. Which, yeah, this, like, it felt like a lot of the actors, as well as having a lot of fun, like some, like Rebecca Romijn's been in a lot of TV, genre TV shows. So she felt like she was directly into this mode. Like you could, I don't know, I don't think she's been in Legends of Tomorrow, but she was giving it very Legends of Tomorrow.
Gotcha. Kind of
energy, you know, that sort of, you know, CW genre show kind of thing. And yeah, like I think overall I think I didn't care for it as much the first time I saw it, but yeah, it's just a reminder that the cast are all great fun.
I do have to wonder if this episode is why Star Trek Strange New Worlds has this weird obsession with giving us the let's just have a bit of fun episode, like you know the Strange New Worlds of season 3, the musical episode of season 2, the episode I'm dreading of Strange New World season 4, when they're doing puppets and it's just guys, Angel did this already.
Yeah, like what unique thing are they going to bring to it? Are they going to be able to? Because with this, it felt closer to an original series Star Trek,
like you could,
episode than a Buffy episode.
Like, you could do... The thing is, this was basically a holodeck episode in all but name. Like, yeah. you could have had this been, like, if this were DS9, this could be, like, you know how, like, in Our Man Bashir, like, Bashir and Garak are the only people who are playing the program, and everyone else's transporter patterns get caught in the buffer, and they're all acting out the characters they got beamed into.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, this is basically a holodeck episode. But again, it's just like, you know, we have 10 episodes per season. Do we really want to have one of those episodes, one where everyone gets to be silly?
I guess like at least one would do.
Yeah.
As long as you keep it to about that, because yeah, like in a full season, you're going to have multiple episodes where everyone's being a bit silly.
Hmm.
And that's 22. I was just thinking, actually, with the idea of if this was network TV version, would it have ended up being the thing of, at the very start, we discover for the first time that Mbenga has a daughter who is in the buffer? Like, it wouldn't be if this was network TV, it would be strung out over several episodes or years, because you kind of don't get that with Star Trek most of the time. You get some bits in DS9.
But... I mean, you kind of get some in Voyager, because you have them picking up like the children. And like that, because I think you have like Naomi Wildman, and I think later on you get the Borg kids.
Yes. Yeah, I guess maybe then, but yeah. I was just wondering what it would be like to go out of the blue. Oh yes, the Doctor has a daughter in a transporter buffer. So what?
What? Wait, hang on. What? So it's like, okay, so the Nebula's not evil, but then the Nebula does stuff which is kind of evil.
Yeah, but you know, it's a Nebula. It doesn't know. It's apparently a spontaneously generated consciousness called Deborah.
Hey, I'm just alive now. I want you to decide whether your child lives or dies.
Damn straight. I'm coming out all guns blazing into reality now. Yeah. God, I mean, at least it didn't go all Jigsaw with it all. that kind of thing.
That's true.
I like this. Let's do it again. Let's do it more.
Oh, God, what if Star Trek did a Saw?
Oh, please no.
There was an episode of Scooby-Doo Mysteries Incorporated where they basically did a Saw. And it's kind of terrifying because, like, the kids are legitimately in danger.
Oh, wow. I did not realize this.
Of course, this is the same Scooby-Doo show where Jeffrey Combs basically plays H.P. Lovecraft.
I could see that. He could do that really well.
And it's actually a pretty fun show because it alternates between... Because, like, every episode is basically a Scooby-Doo style, you know, it's a guy in a mask. I would have gotten away with it too. There's a great episode where the teacher is the one behind, like, the secret gold thing. And then Fred goes, but you're a teacher. Why would you want to pretend to be a ghost and steal my... Oh, right.
Aww. So
it does play in the kind of self-aware kind of thing.
Okay.
But then in the background, there is some Lovecraftian cult shit going on.
Nice.
And it's... So, like, yeah, Scooby-Doo Mysteries Incorporated... is actually really good, and there is an episode where they basically get stuck in a haunted house with someone doing a jigsaw, and it is actually kind of legitimately terrifying because there is a moment where Fred and Daphne nearly fucking drown.
Oh wow, excellent.
Oh
yeah, and that sounds surprisingly good.
And this is the show where Velma and Shaggy are in a secret relationship that Scooby doesn't know about because Scooby will get jealous.
Oh,
like it's self. And Fred is the best himbo. Like,
oh, good.
Fred just wants to make traps. Fred just wants to hang out with his mates and make traps. He is just like the goodest good, but he's basically a golden retriever in an ascot.
Nice. That does feel like the best way of handling Fred.
Yeah. But to get back to Star Trek, Yeah. this is good fun. It's a good romp. Like you said, I love the whole kind of we're not gonna make a fantasy kingdom. We're gonna set up the ship with plants and cauldrons. Like, yeah, it's fun. It's naff enough to be fun.
Yeah, definitely.
It has very classic Who vibes.
Yeah, actually. That kind of energy, similar to how it has a bit of a classic TOS kind of vibe to it. So, where must it go on the big list? Also, I assume it's going pretty low down on the ship's cats list, given the presence of Runa Ewok.
Oh yeah, this is definitely the worst on the ship's cat list.
Okay, so 33, better or worse than the musical episode?
Okay. This is difficult. I mean this one, okay, both episodes have Bruce Horak in them. So it's like you're making me choose between Hema Hamming Up or K-pop Klingon.
Oh god, yes. Yeah, I forgot was a
And I love all the Star Trek nerds who are angry about K-pop Klingons.
Okay.
It's like, why? It's a joke. But they should be doing up. It's a joke. Okay, yeah. The joke will age really poorly in 5 years when K-pop stops being a big thing over in the West. But for now, it's fun.
Yeah.
We can have fun. I feel that this is slightly better. It's just close enough to like a traditional Trek episode, because like the musical episode, I feel is a bit too self-aware that it breaks Star Trek a little because it feels. I can imagine, like, that the cast of Star Trek would get stuck in someone's fantasy novel, be it holodeck or be it not. Whereas the idea that the cast of Star Trek is stuck in a musical in universe feels a bit too suspension of how it's done. It feels a bit too suspension of disbelief.
Yeah. I get that.
I mean, okay, so above Subspace Rhapsody, we at number 32, we do have Arena, where Kirk fights the Gorn.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Both of these are very good fun.
My God, I would have to say... I think Arena is better.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, but also, Arena's like one of the most quintessentially classic.
It is. It's very iconic. You know, the look of the Gorn, those rocks from, you know, from Bogus Journey.
You know, yeah. Shatner running up and down a mountain. Which must have been as happy as Larry to be out and doing a little run around.
Again, like a small dog.
Yeah.
That said, wasn't this where he got tinnitus?
Yeah, this is where both he and Leonard Nimoy got tinnitus.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. But yeah, I'm good with.
Look, this. It's tinnitus is better than like all those people who filmed westerns in areas of the of New Mexico where the U.S. military had been testing atomic weapons. And all eventually died from cancer.
True, true. There is that. Or, you know, certain people that were filming with John Landis.
Well, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, before things get too grim, that means that it is our new number 33 on the big list. Marvelous stuff. So, that means it's time... to say goodbye. Of course, you can find us online all over the place, because while neither of us are great at actually finishing a number of the things that we've been meaning to, at the same time, we are still terribly online. Yes. So, Miles, where are you terribly online?
Well, you can find me being terribly online on Pornhub. No, wait, no, I don't need to admit that. You can find me on my blog at... mareedlabato.wordpress.com, and you can find me on my Blue Sky at marsreedlabato.bsky.social.
Nice. Yeah, you can find me at fakedtales.com, where hopefully, if I've not put up all my writing about UK Expo here, you are all allowed to make fun of me for that.
At this point, on my blog, there will be a review of the Backrooms, as promised, and there will probably be a follow-up to my last Doctor Who blog, Doctor Who The Reality Disappointment, with Doctor Who The Reality Disappointment Part 2.
Oh, lovely.
Because now I have a whole lot more about Doctor Who to be disappointed about.
True, true. So, Miles, this was my pick. What... do you fancy doing for the next one?
Oh, I want to do Planets Ruled by Computer.
Yeah.
I feel it's been a long time. I think it's been a long time since we watched the cast of Star Trek do regime change. And also, okay. I got to love a planet run by computer.
Okay. So, yeah. Come to us next time where we will be talking about computer bad, probably. I don't know, there might be a benevolent computer somewhere.
There is never a benevolent computer unless we're an alpha complex in which Master Computer is always right and benevolent and loves us very much.
Yeah, it's mandatory, of course, that we are happy and acknowledged friend to computer.
And we must root out the evil deviants, be they mutants or communists.
And we are definitely not either of those.
No.
Okay, well, on that extremely niche reference...
Look, we reference fucking Nightmare in this episode. We go niche.
Yeah. Fair. Right, well, go do a Starfleet and, you know, sprinkle a little magic into it as well.
Spellcasting. JELLYBABY.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Labato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Edited by the hosts and by Rihanna Reed Labato. Star Trek is owned by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.